welcome to the Semiconductor Insiders Podcast Series. The goal of this podcast is to bring semiconductor experts together to get to the truth about the matter at hand. We'll get right to the point and not exceed 30 minutes of your time. If you have a topic you would like us to cover, please post it on semiwiki.com and we'll get right to it. My guest today is Terry Daly. Welcome back, Terry.
Well, thanks, Dan. It's great to be back.
So Terry Daly is a 35-year veteran of the semiconductor industry. He was formerly senior VP at GlobalFoundries, and prior to that, he was an executive at IBM Microelectronics. He is currently an independent consultant and also a senior fellow at the Council on Emerging Market Enterprises at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. Terry, so much to talk about. The semiconductor industry has been front page news for some time now. You know, we have chip shortages, trade wars, sanctions, competition between countries vying for investment with massive subsidies, and now potential legislation that would impose new controls on the ability of firms to operate globally. It truly is an exciting time in the semiconductor industry.
Yeah, indeed.
So before we dig in, can you remind us of what the industry looked like, just some of its key attributes before it became the center of attention from a geopolitical perspective?
Yeah, I think, Dan, it's called Remember the Good Old Days. You know, the industry really exemplified a global kind of interconnected network of companies that were, you know, innovating, creating completely new capability in virtually every end market that we can think of. You know, these companies were competing viciously and still do. But I think by and large, they were playing on a level and unrestricted playing field. I mean, there was always a level of, you know, these national subsidies. Some of us might recall the memory trade wars back in the 80s with Japan, you know, accusations of dumping and anti-dumping legislation. But, you know, the industry by and large has enjoyed free markets. And starting in the mid 80s, as you know well, we saw the transformation of the industry with the creation of the foundry and kind of fabless market segments, disrupting the historic IDM model. That evolved into an industry of really regional core competencies. You know, obviously, very heavy concentration of manufacturing in Asia, very fluid global talent, respect for IP protection, great support of the industry from global capital markets, you know, financial markets, venture capital, private equity, you know, all accelerating and driving innovation and growth. You know, with semis today at the center of this geopolitical storm that you outlined, it might be hard to remember sometimes that this model fostered, in my mind, you know, really great global collaboration, high pace of innovation, great cost efficiency, and, you know, by and large, a truly excellent supply chain.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Terry. That's a good summary. So let's talk about China. Trade relations seem to have been a catalyst to what is now a pretty rapidly changing industry landscape.
Yeah, it clearly has. And, you know, with respect to China, I'd first say this, you know, China, like every country, has a right to pursue and develop any industry it feels it's in its strategic interest. Those can be economic to drive GDP growth, capture more value add, or, you know, reduce the trade imbalance. Those interests, you know, can be stemming from national security, you know, assuring their ability to support their defense, intelligence, cyber, and space segments. The fact is, you know, the US, the EU, Japan, you know, many countries share these objectives. It's not so much whether China has the right to control its destiny, it's really how it's gone about pursuing it. And, you know, as you know, trade sanctions in the form of tariffs were imposed on China by the US under the Trump administration, you know, probably initially as a reaction to a trade imbalance or the trade imbalance between the two countries. Semis were part of that, but there were many other industry groups that were included. But the more kind of targeted use of semiconductors through sanctions came in response to this Section 301 report by the U.S. Trade Rep. I think it was back in 2017. And that detailed a, you know, kind of longstanding and extensive pattern by China of, I say, abrogating its World Trade Obligation, WTO obligations, World Trade Organization obligations. And, you know, these practices included extensive subsidies, especially of state-owned entities, intellectual property theft, forced tech transfers, restrictions on market access. We know, you know, many of them now. And Dan, I think, you know, companies in our industry had been complaining about these issues for years, but had been reluctant largely to speak publicly for the fear of losing, you know, their business in China. Trade sanctions became part of a broader landscape of U.S.-China pressure points that, you know, broadened out to include human rights, the more aggressive buildup of China's armed forces, militancy in, you know, South and East China Seas, Hong Kong, et cetera. So sanctions were put in place over several rounds. These are well known. You know, beyond the tariffs, we saw the restricted shipments of categories of chips, placing, you know, companies on the entity list, notably Huawei, SMIC, you know, Fujian, Jinhua, Phytium, and others. And then we saw the imposition of this foreign direct product rule, which really shut down TSMC's and others, but primarily TSMC's ability to supply targeted Chinese companies, you know, if TSMC used U.S. origin equipment in making those parts, which was pretty much always the case. I mean, we're talking about tools from AMAT, LAM, KLA, and others that are well integrated in the process flows. The key U.S. objective shifted to really to a focus on, you know, denying Chinese national security complex access to leading technologies. So, yeah, China's been a particular, you know, kind of focal point, you know, geopolitically that has really impacted the semiconductor landscape.
Yeah, and, you know, today the U.S. and its allies have clearly seen the power of semiconductor sanctions as a weapon of economic warfare. In fact, chip sanctions were at the top of the list with respect to the recent sanctions against Russia, right?
They were. And, you know, in response to, you know, Russia's, you know, really horrific aggression in Ukraine, the U.S. and, you know, most countries around the globe have placed, you know, a range of sanctions on Russia. We see that in the news. And, you know, that included prohibition of shipment of semiconductors. And, you know, those government actions have been coupled with voluntary bans by many companies, you know, Intel, AMD, and others. I guess the question, Dan, is, you know, whether it matters or will have any impact on Russian action. The sanctions are clearly symbolic, but they're also intended to deny access of critical technology to Russia, especially its military. I mean, separately, you know, Russia's kind of TAM in the industry, you know, is, I understand, like less than 0.1% of global semiconductor industry sales. So, you know, that loss of that business is not really going to have a direct impact on industry revenue, but there could be a couple knock-on effects. You know, there's always a challenge of denying dual-use technologies and closing off, you know, what are in many cases very creative global distribution channels for parts. You know, second, the U.S. is, you know, leaning on Chinese firms not to backfill this embargoed supply, you know, or they face the risk of being added to the entity list. So that'll be interesting to follow. You know, and finally, Russia, I think, you know, does have some retaliatory options, so to speak, with respect to semiconductors, which we can discuss.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So let's talk about the potential for retaliation, perhaps by Russia. Let's start. First, let's start with China. You know, given the broad sanctions you laid out earlier, what are the levers that China has, and you know, do you think they will actually use them?
Yeah, excuse me. In my view, I think there is a risk of retaliation by China. You know, global companies need to be assessing these risks and, you know, taking mitigation actions, which I'm sure is happening. I know it's happening. You know, as the U.S. and, you know, its partners are kind of, my words, increasingly weaponizing the semiconductor industry in support of political objectives, they do face this dual-edged sword, which is one of retaliation. You know, China has some control points, you know, in the industry that can be used as leverage against the West. You know, first, China controls about 38% of global market share of package assembly and test, you know, what we know as the OSAT segment. That's a critical leverage point. Second, China controls the supply line for several kind of rare earths and precious metals used in semiconductor manufacturing. You know, many of the listeners here have probably, you know, read some of the Boston Consulting BCG reports that, you know, of 17 rare earths key to the semiconductor industry, China leads in the extraction of 9 of them and the refining of 14, with roughly an 80% share of rare earths. So, you know, overcoming a Chinese boycott on these materials by investing new capacity elsewhere is a much longer lead time than, say, rebalancing global OSAT, you know, production. You know, in addition, you know, China has the ability to frustrate the industry by withholding approval of M&A deals, putting political or operational pressure on key multinational fabs on the mainland. You know, think of Samsung, SK, TSMC. And, you know, finally, there's the kind of ultimate geopolitical move that's the subject of a lot of speculation, with respect to Taiwan. And, you know, I do think the global community needs to be sober in its assessment of China's position on Taiwan. They've made a commitment to kind of repatriate the renegade province as they view it and get it back under the control, or get it under the control, get Taiwan under the control of the PRC. That would be, kind of a nuclear option, so to speak, for China to take. Russia on their side, has some retaliatory leverage, I think, by impacting global supplies of neon and palladium, kind of in concert with Ukraine, where between them they have a large percent share. You may have seen the great article in Tom's Hardware website, the two Ukrainian companies, one in Odessa and one in Mariupol, that we hear a lot in the news, are suppliers of high purity neon gas and supply roughly 50% of the industry needs, semiconductor industry, and both have been forced to halt shipments due to the war. I think many companies were ahead of that in terms of proactive actions to get supply, but nonetheless, depending on the duration of this war in Ukraine, that could become a pressure point. Whether China or Russia in fact retaliate using these levers is unknown, problematic. In China's case, doing so would impose really, I think, self-inflicted pain with respect to access to technology, and would invoke additional response by the U.S. and its allies. But that said, Dan, not every actor, as we've seen on the global stage, is rational, underscoring the case for this risk assessment and mitigation by the industry.
The response that we've seen from the U.S. and other governments around the world is, we're seeing governments announcing subsidies to establish security of supply, and including the U.S. with the CHIPS Act. Can you give us an update on that piece of U.S. legislation?
Yeah, and what we're seeing is now, I think, a wave of what I call techno-nationalism. It's really major powers around the world responding with kind of good old-fashioned industrial policy, subsidies, tax breaks, grants, other forms of financial support, all with the objective of incenting semiconductor manufacturing to invest in their respective countries. I'm sure most listening to this podcast are, pretty aware of the proposed legislation in the U.S., as you mentioned, the CHIPS Act. And, this is the proposal for the U.S. to invest in semiconductor research and development and manufacturing at tune of roughly $52 billion. The CHIPS Act has been embedded in kind of larger bills, both in the Senate and the House, both of which have passed in their respective chambers. Currently, these bills are in conference committee. And, what that means is the two chambers are negotiating their differences ostensibly into a single piece of legislation, and they vote again to approve it and send it to the president's desk for signature. Most in the industry, I think, would find it kind of unwieldy, is the process, the composition of this joint group conferencing these bills. The Senate has appointed 26 members and the House 80 members. Both are equally split between the parties. So we have 116 members of Congress at the table with the objective to reach bipartisan agreement on a piece of legislation. That's lots of agendas to bring under one tent, no less than an election year. So that's the CHIPS Act. I think also, proposed in the U.S. is, it's known as the FABS Act. Facilitating American Built Semiconductors is the acronym. And whereas the CHIPS Act is largely subsidization or direct investment, the FABS Act proposes semiconductor investment tax credit for both manufacturing and design. So it's a little bit different angle, but with a similar objective to stimulate investment in the industry. As an aside, Dan, and probably it's the same on your end, I can say, in my career, I can't recall such an avalanche of lobbying by our industry on legislation. No doubt social media has kind of amplified, the efforts by the SIA, SEMI, GSA, and others, but it's a really big megaphone. That's where I think things sit at this point, still very much in process.
Yeah, I think people's inability to get cars really brought it to the forefront, since that touches everybody. You know, my daughter tried to buy a car, and she had to wait for months and didn't really get to pick what she wanted and had to pay a premium. But that seems to be the way things are. But if you take away people's cars, that's going to really spur political action, especially in an election year.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So what about other initiatives around the globe?
Yeah, there's a lot happening. You know, the EU has, you know, got a proposal for spending, I think it's up to 30 billion euros. You know, interestingly, separate note on Spain, which has not really materially been in the semiconductor scene, I think, since the days of Philips, you know, pre-NXP, is proposing 11 billion euros to kickstart, you know, semiconductor investment in Spain. You know, of course, you know, China remains a gorilla on the field, so to speak, doubling down on, you know, its Made in China 2025 initiative, continuing to, you know, spend upward to and perhaps past $150 billion. Their recent five-year plan has really updated their goal for semiconductor industry to be one of self-sufficiency across the value chain. You know, South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, India, you know, they've all put forth government subsidies. Interestingly, you know, with Taiwan, you know, one of the specific objectives is to build out kind of an enhanced ecosystem, in their case, around semiconductor manufacturing equipment to reduce dependency on this U.S. origin equipment and kind of get out from under the constraints of U.S. political objectives. You know, today it's Huawei or, a Chinese customer, you know, TSMC's got to be saying, well, who is it tomorrow? You know, how long can I live like this? You know, I think finally Russia, interestingly, I saw a recent announcement of their intent to invest up to $30 billion in semiconductor manufacturing. Now, you know, as I think you know, Russia from a manufacturing standpoint has largely been absent, in the industry and ineffective in building out a, semiconductor manufacturing capability. But they've been well integrated into the industry model through over the past couple decades through kind of the fabless model. But, you know, supply to those firms is now largely shut down. And, you know, the likelihood of a Russian manufacturing company, subsidies or not, getting access to Western equipment is, you know, unlikely to happen for the foreseeable future, to say the least.
So what about the legislative front? We understand that Congress is considering additional rules that would constrain outbound investment, especially as it relates to critical technologies like semiconductors. Do you have any insight on what's going on here?
Yeah, actually, you know, many, you know, in the industry are familiar with CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the U.S. You know, that's,
right.
You know, for simplicity, kind of the capability of the U.S. government to deny a foreign company the ability to acquire an interest in a U.S. company, and sometimes even, you know, denying the interest to acquire a non-U.S. company if it has business activity in the U.S. So that's the inbound investment. What's under consideration now, kind of as a complement to CFIUS, some legislation put forth by Senators Casey and Cornyn to control outbound investment, as you said. And, you know, this is outbound investment by U.S. companies or other parties. And this could take the form of restricting joint ventures, licensing deals, M&A, and potentially even financial investments in foreign entities. Those can be either from industry or, you know, from private equity and venture capital. And the reason, you know, stated reason is pretty clear. It's, you know, quote, national security, limiting certain countries, and it's really primarily, I believe, targeted to China, limiting their access to key technologies, know-how, and capital markets. You know, the capital market angle is interesting. You know, venture capital flows are viewed as generating kind of unique risk to national security by certain, you know, government parties. Because they face less reporting, they're kind of harder to track. But also, as you know, Dan, they provide really early stage companies with expert advice on how to develop and scale businesses. They provide access to financial networks and, you know, they can bring positive reputational return. So that's an interesting, you know, development that we could see. You know, all that said, in my view, you know, any policy action in this space needs to balance, you know, what are justifiable national security restrictions, equally with, you know, the U.S. kind of traditional broad commitment to, you know, an open market-based, you know, approach. And it's also got to recognize that global capital is fungible and multinational firms are mobile. So both capital and corporations have choices on investment. But that will be some, you know, interesting legislation to watch for the industry.
Yeah, I agree.
So let's wrap it up, Terry.
What are your thoughts on how all this is going to end up? What might the industry look like in 5 to 10 years?
That's a tough question. I mean, you know, first, you know, there seems to be a consensus forming around this $1 trillion revenue, you know, industry by 2030 for semiconductors. I mean, that's a lot of growth. You know, that's 7, probably 8% compound growth uninterrupted over the next 8 years. And so supporting that growth will require, you know, a lot of new capacity for sure. And we've seen some impressive announcements of, you know, multi-year, multi-hundred-billion-dollar investments in new fab capacity by Intel, TSMC, Samsung, SK. So there's a lot of questions, obviously, you know, where will all this investment be made? And, you know, will the industry look past the current geopolitical situation we've been discussing and kind of stay with the model of the last 10 to 20 years of strong regional competencies? You know, or will these subsidies and enticements modify sourcing material on a geographic basis? To what extent will countries really chase, you know, self-sufficiency? And, you know, what might be the implications? So there's a lot of questions. I think in my mind, there's kind of three primary scenarios that could play out. The first could be, you know, this decoupling that we have read a lot about, you know, specifically that's, you know, kind of China versus the rest of the world into kind of two separate ecosystems. The second is balkanization, so to speak, of the industry into regional or kind of ideological blocks. And there could be, you know, different permutations of that model. And the third could be reintegration, where we'd see, you know, nations around the world dropping the use of sanctions and kind of the semiconductor industry getting extracted from being used as an economic weapon, you know, in geopolitics. If I had to place a bet, I think it'd be kind of on a mixed model. I think one where China continues to be integrated on mature and mainstream technologies, but continue to be blocked with respect to access to the leading edge. I do not think China has a chance of becoming self-sufficient up and down the value chain, you know, by 2030, honestly, and, you know, which would include, you know, equipment, process technology development, especially on the leading edge, design tools, and as well as manufacturing. I do think we'll see, you know, a decline in the concentration of manufacturing, at least percentage-wise in Asia, probably absolute growth, you know, absent some, you know, catastrophe in Taiwan or South Korea. But I think percentage-wise, we'll see a, you know, a shift away from Asia as subsidies in the U.S. and Europe, you know, entice new fab capacity. I also think, Dan, we're going to see an industry that's less efficient from a perspective of capacity utilization and cost, but one that maybe has more redundancy in its supply chain. You know, then on the geopolitical front, you know, we're in this battle of kind of call it small L liberal democracies versus autocracies, and, you know, which vision, which set of rules is going to govern global affairs for the balance of the 21st century. And control of chips are likely to continue to be part of that battle. So I don't know. I guess in the end, I have more questions than answers, but it will be fascinating as it unfolds.
Yeah, I find it interesting that the sanctions against Russia, you know, don't include gas and oil because Russia's kind of a big gas station, right? So they're supplying some of the countries that are sanctioning them with gas and oil. And I see semiconductors as gaining that type of importance. So that's what I see in the future. And we're going to have to figure it out, how to work better together or how to protect this supply chain. And, you know, I don't think you can separate gas and oil, you know, regionally. You know, some countries have it and some countries don't. I think that's the same way with semiconductors. But maybe we can, you know, reshore semiconductors well enough that it won't be an issue. But today, I don't see that. But anyway, hey, well, thanks again for your time, Terry. Great content, great conversation. It's always nice to talk to you. And thank you, everyone, for participating in the Semiconductor Insiders podcast series. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Dan.
That concludes our podcast. Thank you all for listening and have a great day.